Lima.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me on the podcast. Cannot wait to talk to you.
You're welcome. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to
Right, so anybody that doesn't know, Halima is a mental health advocate and support coach. So thank you for joining us. When I did a bit of research about you and your story, I was amazed at how many common threads I saw in my own journey. And you sort of mentioned that it started with issues around self-esteem. Can you sort of
Yes.
tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so in school, I mean, generally my school life wasn't so bad, but a lot of the time people used to make remarks about the way that I looked. So people used to laugh at me in regards to my physical appearance. And I had other things going on as well because my mental health issues started from very early on. So having, what should be an outlet for a child that's having struggles. School wasn't somewhere where I felt like I was able to be at peace. And through those remarks, through that part of the bullying, that impacted my self-esteem hugely, and I started to become very paranoid, about the way that I looked. And this played like a huge part of my life and then my future because that only got worse as time went on. So the older I got, the worse my self-esteem issues became, and the more things about myself I was getting paranoid about. And it really led me into a very bad place where a lot of my anxiety was about my physical appearance. And I literally, like, I couldn't live my day-to-day life peacefully because, if one hair was out of place, I would try to find the nearest friend that lived to where I was to try and straighten my hair, or I'd carry around a hairbrush with me and literally be brushing my hair paranoid like 24/7. So, yeah, it started off in school with just a few remarks, but it really spiraled out of control as I got older.
That's quite similar to me, but I think the way I took it is I decided to create an image of myself that I wanted to be. So I tried to be and create a persona completely opposite to who I actually was. Is that something you attempted or?
Mine was interesting. I don't really think I knew who I was. I was always just trying to be somebody else. I was always trying to be somebody that I thought everybody else wanted me to be. So I don't really think that I ever knew who I was. I didn't really take the time to get to know me because I obviously didn't feel like I was worth knowing, if that makes sense. It was the case of who did the people around me expect me to be? Who do I need to be, and how do I need to behave in order to be socially acceptable? And that was exactly how I would behave. That's exactly, how I would talk, how I would act, the things that I would do, the places that I would go. It was all just to be acceptable to the people that were around me.
Yeah, I remember as well. You're quite a similar age to me. Social media was in its infancy when I was around 12, 13, and that played a massive part in it as well, I think. So even social media profiles had to have the right music on them, the right look on them. I'm not sure if that's something that affected you as well.
Social media thankfully didn't have that much of a big impact on me, because again, like you said, it was only just starting to come around like during my teenage years. So when I was like in those crucial stages of my life, thankfully, and everybody around me anyway, social media was just kind of like that thing that you did where you would literally post up like the most irrelevant things, like, I just bought a new pair of trainers, and then you'd filter them so much so they didn't even look like how they did in real life anyway. And like it would just literally be like things like that, the whole filter and, changing yourself to look a certain way, and the whole concept of social media influencers, that was never like it wasn't about at that time. So thankfully, that didn't impact me. But I reckon if I was at that age now, the way that social media is now, it probably would have had a big impact on me because the whole concept of the image that society is deeming as what's pretty and what's not, definitely has a big, impact in the mental health and the mental state of a lot of young girls today. So thankfully, I was safe from that, but a lot of people aren't.
And again, I find so many similarities between us, actually. Researching into you, I know that unfortunately you've experienced different forms of abuse or pretty much all the way through your journey. And I've sort of lived in a situation where coercive control was present as well.
Yeah.
How did you sort of find the inner strength to leave those sorts of situations? Because for me, it took me 7 whole years to leave my
Wow.
experience.
Wow. Well, firstly, I'm happy that you did. It's not a nice place to be whatsoever. Mine was actually a marriage, so it was even harder for me to walk out of it because I felt like I'd made this lifelong commitment. And I've seen around me, I've seen marriages that have fallen apart and I've seen marriages that have stayed strong. And I always wanted to be like, I took marriage seriously. I said to myself, if I get married to somebody, like, I'm not going to run away at the first sight of trouble. And even though from a logical perspective, you would look at it and say, well, if you're being abused, it's the logical thing is to leave. It's toxic. You can't be in there. It doesn't matter if you're married or not. I looked at it in the sense of, no, I'm married, so therefore I need to fight for my marriage. I need to help him. Maybe he's got problems and whatnot. But then it was a very vicious cycle. So like I tried to leave at points where I felt like it was getting too much, but I always ended up going back, whether it was because of the emotional blackmail or the manipulation or me just feeling weak, thinking that there was nowhere else that I could go. Like there were so many reasons, but I just kept going back. And the one time that really made the most difference was when I finally told my family about it and they had encouraged me like to walk away. And even though I did run back to him again after that, I lived without him for a few weeks. And in those few weeks, I had a taste of how peaceful my life was without him. And that made me realize what I was experiencing wasn't normal. So when we did get back together and, a situation occurred and he lost his temper and I saw the situation escalating, I managed to get out of there quickly before he even had the chance to do anything and use the neighbor's phone to call the police. Of course, the whole process of moving on was long and traumatic in itself, and there were so many more complex elements to it. But the most important thing was is that I was no longer physically there. And that also highlights the importance of having like support because I never would have been able to experience that period of time not having him, which in the end became the strength that gave like that was how I developed the strength to leave him in the end. So, I mean, if there is anyone listening to this that knows someone who's in an abusive relationship and they're refusing to leave, I urge you not to turn your back on them because one day they're going to need that moment in their lives that I did when I had those 3 weeks. And that's going to help them see the light, and there's no way they're going to be able to do that themselves. So it's so important to have that, because I think that I still either would have been with him or the situation would have got a lot worse for me had I not had the opportunity to be away from him for a while and experience that peaceful side of life,
I think for me, with my situation, it was a pride thing. I was so scared of people thinking I was a failure. In my situation, I'd moved 200 miles away from any of my friends and family, so this person was the only person I had.
I resonate with
And you somehow feel guilty. All their actions are obviously completely wrong, but somehow you feel guilty for doing it, for thinking about leaving even. And I've got to say, maybe within the first 6 months, I knew it was the wrong thing for me. And then 7 years later, I finally left, because I just snapped. I'd got to that point where you just can't turn back. You just snap.
There's always something, isn't it, that just like that clicks and makes you realize that that's it, this is it, I'm done now. But for different people it takes something different and it takes different lengths of time. Like for me it took 10 months, but for you it took 7 years. Like it's a different journey for everybody. And it's different things happen that trigger different decisions in your mind. So I think it's very important to highlight that different people are ready for different periods, and the fact that you're far away from the people that you loved. And it was the same with me as well. I was far away from my family and my friends, so I literally didn't have anybody physically around me except from him and his family and his close friends. And that was another thing that was harder for me because I felt like he was all that I had. So I totally like align with what you've said. And I think a lot of people will as well.
Did you find that person understanding of your anxiety anyway? Because my partner at the time was very, very dismissive and probably made me feel 10 times worse and made me feel guilty about having anxiety.
Yeah, he was not sympathetic, not empathetic. In fact, being in that environment, in that marriage, with all everything that was going on, actually made my mental health decline. So because of all of the abuse that I was going through, my anxiety got so much worse. And it got to a point where I literally couldn't even hold on to a job for longer than a couple of weeks because I was having panic attacks at work and then having to leave. And then I was so scared of going back so that I just wouldn't go back. And then I'd have to get a new job and the same thing would happen over and over and over again. And instead of obviously giving me that support or maybe acknowledging his part to play, he just used to get frustrated with me and annoyed because I couldn't keep hold of a job, which meant that he had to make more money to cover the expenses and everything. And obviously that made me feel pretty worthless because I've always been very independent. So me not even being able to contribute anything, I just felt so bad about myself and I felt worthless. And like you said, it's the guilt that comes in. And because of that, you end up putting that person on an even higher pedestal because you're saying, oh my God, like my mind frame was like, oh my gosh, he's working so hard for us and he's bringing in all this money and he's like looking after me and I owe him. So maybe it's okay that he's a bit annoyed with me and maybe it's all right that he's a bit angry. Like, you just take the blame on yourself and downplay the problem.
You try and justify it in any way possible, don't you, I think. And I think similarly, I'm not sure in your situation, but with my family, I think I've always felt guilty about having mental health issues because I didn't want them to worry. So that makes my anxiety worse. I don't know. There's just this massive air of guilt that I've always felt with my mental health. I'm not sure how you feel.
Do you know what it is? It's completely normal, though, because even today in our society, there are a lot of stigmas when it comes to mental health. And because of those stigmas, that's why people feel really reluctant to speaking out about the problems that they're going through, the things that they're experiencing, seeking help, seeking support. Like, most people don't even know how to communicate what they're feeling. And most people don't even know what they're feeling because no one's ever, like, we were never taught growing up that this is what depression is. This is how you'll typically seem to feel if you have it. This is anxiety. This is that. Like, we were never taught these things growing up. So when we do go through them and we experience these things, we are too scared to talk about it because we don't even understand it ourselves, or we're scared of judgment and like the stigmas that are currently attached to it, especially for men, where they're looked at as weak just because, you know, they show their emotions. And it's because of those reasons and so many other reasons that obviously we just feel like we can't talk. But then the opposite of depression is expression. So if we're holding things in, we can't get better. We're only going to get worse. Speaking is the most powerful form of therapy. And if we're not doing that, then of course we're going to get worse. And, you know, thankfully we've come a long way, society has at the moment, but there's still so much work to be done. And I think it's very important to increase the awareness and the importance of speaking and the importance of listening to those that need us to hear them.
Yeah, definitely. The biggest thing that I ever did in my journey was the first time I spoke to someone. That's all. The biggest thing I ever did. But I think we have come a long way. As you said, there's a lot more to be done, especially around men's mental health. My dad is actually a severe anxiety sufferer too, but he will never actually say the word anxiety ever. It's really, really strange. And he knows that I suffer as well now. And we have this sort of unwritten, unspoken language with each other, but he will never acknowledge his own illness. He never sees it as an illness.
It's like admitting it then makes it real. Then maybe he also comes from that perspective where he thinks that if he admits it, then he's not a man or he's weak. And a man doesn't want to, like, he doesn't want to have that where he's looked at as weak or not man enough, because it's very important to men and to have that sense of manliness. But I don't know where it comes from. It's society's beliefs, and it's that whole toxic masculinity where a man has to be strong, a man has to be tough, a man can't be upset, men can't show their emotions, and if you do anything that contradicts that, then you're not a man. And that's why it's harder for men to come to terms with these things.
Yeah, definitely. I think, again, something that came across to me really strongly in my research about, you know, your work, is you spoke about your attempted suicide, and it's something I've recently spoken about in my own attempt. And you said it was maybe the most important day for you, and you needed that to happen. And for me, I come from a similar place, actually. It was probably the most joyous day of my life at the time, because I'd come to a realisation with my anxiety that I could control it, and I'd accepted it, and I actually felt glad that I could be out of this battle with my mind, and no one would be able to question me about it, because I wouldn't be around anymore. Do you feel when that happened to you, did you feel any, I was personally numb after I'd realised what I'd tried to do. How did you look on it? How did you reflect on it in those immediate moments after realising what you
I'd say I was numb as well, definitely. But my thought process, like, on that day, it was never premeditated. I'd never had come up with a plan and decided to do it. It was something that, as I was going through the motions of the day, I realised how tired I was of just life in general. So it was a decision that I made on the spot, even though I'd tried to take my own life a few times before that. I'd always chickened out of it. I'd always been too scared to follow it through, or I'd partially followed it through and then not carried it on. And this time I just felt like I'd had enough. My whole life I looked at it as just one big tragic event, and there was one bad thing after another. So I was just tired of going through pain, and I just wanted to live life without experiencing pain, and I didn't see that ever happening. So I just wanted to stop the hurt. I wanted to stop the pain. I wanted to stop bad things happening. And the only way I felt to do that was just to stop my life completely. So when I was lying there, like, thinking that my attempt had worked and that I'd be dead at any point, there was a mixture of emotions, but it was just, there was no joy, but there was no regret either. I was just there. I was just waiting, you know. It's like you said, you were numb. That was just how I felt. There was no thought. There was no, you know, maybe I wish I'd done things differently, or there was no thinking about my life and what I would have done differently. There was nothing. Like, it was literally just lying there with a totally blank mind, just waiting for everything to go dark. But it definitely was, definitely was, like, the best thing that could have happened to me, because sometimes you need to hit rock bottom in order to come up. And because of all the different things that I'd been through in my life, whether it was the childhood trauma, whether it was the mental health issues, the homelessness, the abuse that I'd gone through, like, there were so many things that happened. And because of those things that happened, I had developed so many toxic traits. I'd developed so many issues internally. And if I hadn't gone through my suicide attempt and I hadn't been sectioned and then gone through that recovery afterwards, I never would have healed all of the things and the issues that I had got as a result of all the things that happened in my life. So that's why I look at it as a blessing, because if I hadn't had that moment where I ended up in hospital, I never would have tackled all of the other things, and I'd probably still be living a very toxic lifestyle today. So I am grateful for it in a way.
Yeah, I feel the same. When I say joy, I think at the time it felt joyous, because it was actually something that I was premeditating to do, to leave my toxic relationship, actually. So it felt joyous in the way that, you know, no, this person couldn't get to me anymore. But again, the moments after, you do feel numb, and you don't feel like that was you doing that.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you said that, because I think it shows the difference that even though people, like, there's so many people out there that have tried or are trying to take their own lives, everybody comes from a different perspective when they're doing it. Like, you have that feeling of, I'm so glad that I'm doing this because now he can't get to me. And it's like somebody else might feel a completely different way, but ultimately you're there for the same reason. You're there for the same outcome. You want to end your life. And it's interesting to acknowledge the differences in reasoning as well. And it's not just like a one template fits all. It's not like everyone that's suicidal is suicidal for the same reason.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have, you know, the images of someone in, obviously you are in the depths of depression to get there, but there's just an image, that stereotypical image, I think, that people have of you in a dark room. Mm. And
how you would expect to see in a movie or something. It's not like that. I was on a field, you know, like I was on a field across the road from a petrol station. Like, there's no template like of how it should pan out.
No, not at all. And again, going back to men's health, it's scary, the statistics of people under 25, men under 25 taking their own life. It's absolutely frightening.
It's devastating. And generally, mental health is the biggest killer in young people. And it's very saddening because these things can easily be avoided if we had the right systems in place, if we had the right professionals in place, if there was more awareness and more education so that people become more conscious of these things and can see the signs and can treat people better so that it doesn't lead to these things happening. Like, there's so many things that we could do that are very simple but would be so effective if it was to happen. That's why, like, it's so upsetting because of the fact that it's something that can easily be changed, but it's not being at the moment.
Yeah, we were talking about this, you know, the admins that all were for making mental health positive. None of us can actually remember anyone at school saying the phrase mental health in any lesson.
I don't remember
whatsoever.
It either. Like, I don't have any memories of being younger where people would talk about mental health, which is why it took years for me to even understand what I was going through. It's only now that I look back on my life where I'm like, okay, yeah, I was clearly suffering from depression at that point. But at that point, I never even knew because I didn't know what it was because no one ever spoke about it.
We actually was talking about the scenario that if you were at school now and you went to the school nurse with a mental health problem, is a school nurse trained in anything like that or has any knowledge of how to deal with things like that? We need some sort of set thing on the curriculum, I think, because it's
definitely
such a big problem.
It's so important that this needs to be not even just in the school curriculum, but in workplaces as well. Like, just in general, it needs to be. Yeah. Mental health is it's a necessity in regards to education, in regards to support sources. So having some people, and not even just the school nurses, but the teachers, employers, employees, like everybody, no matter what level you're in, what your role is in wherever it is that you work, mental health education is something that every single person needs because of the fact that mental health affects everybody, because we all have minds, therefore we all have mental health. Just some people have poor mental health and some people have good mental health. So everybody needs to be educated, because at some point in everybody's life, you will experience something that will decline the state of your mental health. Just some people are able to come through it healthily and some people aren't. And that's why, because obviously in school, as children, most mental health illnesses are developed when you're younger. So it needs to start off with the kids because that's where the issues come from. And if they're tackled at there and then at that time, it would save so much trauma, so much devastation, so many issues, and so many crises that would then happen later on in life. Because there's so many people that, like, I've seen, and there's people that I've known even personally recently, not recently, but last year, I found out that somebody I went to school with actually killed himself, jumped off a parking lot. And I remember in school that he did used to get bullied a little bit, and he had irrational behaviours, and if, you know, with the education and the knowledge that I have now, I reckon if I was a teacher and saw that, I would realize that those were warning signs for something that bad that could then happen in the future, and I'd tackle it there and then. But obviously due to lack of education, when we were in school, no one would have looked at that in any way whatsoever and just would have ruled it off as just kids being kids.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I can pinpoint my anxiety starting around the age of 8. That's a hell of a long time to go through a school system and not be able to speak to anyone. So it needs to be in place. You know, children at the age of 3, 4 learn about emotions, but then it doesn't really go anywhere from there. It's either I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm angry,
and even being,
and no in between.
When kids do experience these things, they're often shut off or dismissed very, very quickly. For some reason, people don't think that kids have the right to express their emotions. You know, when they cry, it's like, stop crying. Or when they're when the young person is stressed, it's like, what do you have to be stressed about? You know, your parents pay all your bills for you. You don't have any responsibilities. You don't have a reason to be stressed. Like, what do you know about stress? And it's just, it's so toxic, that whole mindset that just because you're young, you can't experience negative emotions. And it's like, as adults, like so many of us, like so many adults don't even know how to process their own emotions. But then we expect kids to know how to do the same thing. Like, yeah. Of course not. They're way more fragile than us. Their emotional intelligence typically is not as there as an adult. And they're not as emotionally intelligent. They're not as emotionally mature. Their minds aren't fully developed. So there's so much that they don't understand. So we need to give them the space and the chance to actually express their emotions and figure out how to express their emotions, because they still don't get the basics of life, and you expect them to handle their emotions in a better way than us as fully grown adults do. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. You putting it like that, actually, in you know, very simple terms, it is bizarre the way society, you know, deals with emotions.
100%,
really, really strange.
But it's made me very, very conscious of that as well. And I'm grateful for being able to see this in a different light, because the way that I behave towards children is so different now compared to the way that I was before I became aware of, like, anything related to mental health. And I know now that also when I have my own kids, I know what kind of a parent I'm going to be. And I'm grateful that I know that I'm going to be a very conscious parent because of the fact that I'm aware of all these things. Like, I will always make sure that my children are able to express their emotions. And if they don't understand how to express their feelings, I will give them the space to take charge of the situation so they can figure out how to do it, you know, because suppressing them only makes it worse. And it ends up with emotionally immature adults that have all these unhealthy coping mechanisms.
Yeah, and I think it's also important, I'm a mum of two, I always allow my children to see my emotions too. I'm not saying that they see me when I'm at my worst, but it's okay for mum to cry. It's okay to be having a bad day.
Yeah, exactly. That's so important.
Because
it's normal.
That
as well, because it's like, we often see, again, it's like you hide things from your kids because you're like, no, they're too young and they shouldn't see this and they shouldn't hear me doing this. And it's like, actually, no, give kids more credit, because they need to see these things because it teaches them. They need to see it teaches them to be more aware. It gives them more education on just things, again, like you said, that are normal. And if they understand and they acknowledge, okay, you know, my mum sometimes gets sad or my dad sometimes gets sad, but look, they're happy now, which means that it's not permanent and things like that. And that will be a big lesson for them. And when they see that you're open around them and you don't hide things from them, that also builds that relationship where they feel like they can also be the same around you. And as a parent, I'm sure you'd agree that you would prefer to be the person that knows what your child is experiencing before anybody else, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, me growing up, my parents were brilliant. I'm not faulting them, but I didn't feel that I could open up to him because I knew that my dad was masking his mental illness. So I didn't want to trigger him because he didn't normalize his mental illness to me until I was an adult, really. So it's definitely important for me that my children see a range of emotions and realize that's just normal day-to-day
Yeah, and
for
props to
mum,
you for being
and
like
that's
that because,
okay.
you know, there's a lot of parents out there who aren't aware of these things, and unfortunately, when you're not aware of these things, you're passing toxic traits on, and then creating like generation after generation that has these toxic beliefs. So somebody needs to be that person that changes it and breaks that stigma, and they call it generational curses. So it's like somebody needs to break that generational curse and create new culture and healthier culture in the family. So good on you for allowing your children to see that and experience it with you.
Would you say that, obviously with the pandemic, would you say that you've seen a more people
Oh, for sure.
contacting
Yeah,
you in terms of their
definitely.
mental
With the
health?
pandemic, suicide stats have shot through the roof. Anxiety has gotten worse. Depression has gotten worse. There are so many people that find themselves in situations that they now have never been in, and they don't know how to handle job losses, not being able to see your loved ones, not being able to go out and do the things that, you know, they would have been able to do and loved and enjoyed. So there's so many people that I've spoken to that have lost their sense of self during this time, and they just don't know what to do with themselves, and they're like, so they feel really depressed, or their anxiety has increased. And especially like a few people that I've been working with recently, like their lifestyle change like has played a big part in the decline of their mental health. So a lot of what I'm doing at the moment is just working through the day-to-day life with people and their routines and their habits, because especially obviously with the pandemic, we're very limited on what we can do at the moment. So we have to try and find a way to be able to promote positive mental health while still obviously staying in line with the restrictions that are being put on. It's something that's not easy because people have different outlets, and some people like to go out and be social, which they can't do anymore. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is focused on finding solutions to all of these problems and making that improvement in mental health. But yeah, there's a lot of people that are suffering right now, and a lot of people that aren't speaking out about the fact that they're suffering, but we know it's there.
Would you say, if you don't mind me asking, has
I
it
found the
affected your
first few
mental health in
weeks of
any
the
way?
initial lockdown back in March, I found that very difficult because I've always been out and about physically a lot. Like my work pre-COVID involved a lot of public speaking. I used to do a lot of outdoor activities in order to keep my mental health positive. I always like to keep active. I like to spend time with nature and get a lot of fresh air, even if it was just reading and writing and doing my work and stuff. I like to go out to cafes or to the parks and stuff like that. I never really used to stay indoors. So it was a big change for me. And I did struggle the first few weeks, but eventually I managed to sit down and have a look at my life and figure out a solution to everything. And within a month, I'd say I was definitely back on track. But it was pretty hard for me at the beginning. I think what helped me was taking a look at what I used to do before the lockdown and what emotions I used to feel as a result of the things that I was doing on a day-to-day basis. And then I just had a look at the things that I could do in line with the restrictions that would give me those same emotions. And then I just tailored my day-to-day life around that and found solutions to it all. And that's another thing that I'm working on, obviously, with the people that come to me for support, is focusing on the emotions that they used to get and how we can still achieve those via something different.
I would say for me, actually, it was completely the opposite. I quite enjoyed the lockdown, and I know that sounds bizarre, and I think it might be
Yeah.
due to I have quite bad social anxiety as well. So I actually found
You know, there's
it
a lot of
quite
people that will think the
nice, the
same as well.
distancing to begin with. But then I think it's definitely a social anxiety thing. But obviously then family, that's particularly difficult. But other than not being able to see family, I did quite enjoy it, to be quite honest. And I've managed to, find this page and find
But
my
you found
voice
your
from
voice,
somewhere. I'm
and
not
that's the
quite
most
sure where
important
it's
thing.
come from, but I've managed. Yeah, I think it's because a lot more people are looking to peer support at the moment. Obviously, we haven't got primary healthcare services in there at the moment, face to face, that sort of thing. So people are looking for peer support. And I do a mental health check-in every week, and the amount of people that say that peer support just does help, knowing that someone understands you and they've been through the same thing. It's incredible. And I think it's as much as professionals do help, I think people that have been through the same as you, it's so
Yeah,
validating, and you
it's
finally
very
feel like you're
important to
understood.
have people around you that can empathize with the way that you're feeling because they actually know what it's like. That's why for me, one of my, one of my USPs is the fact that I've been there and I know exactly how it feels because I've been there, I've done it, I've worn the t-shirt, I've gone through the whole cycle. And that's why my approach is also very different. I can't take anything away from people that, go purely down the educational route, but it does definitely make a difference when somebody has experienced what you have, what you are now experiencing, and that they've come out the other side.
It's why I found it's so interesting that you decided to take control of your recovery rather than let professionals have control. I find that so interesting. Is that something that you still do? Would you say you still plan out your own recovery just to keep in check
Yeah,
that you're
definitely.
still
I mean,
okay and you're
initially, obviously, when
still
I came
being
out
able
of
to
hospital and
function?
I decided to take my recovery into my own hands, it was a very risky choice to make because, like I said, I was fresh out of hospital. I was still in a very unhealthy place. Like it had been less than a month since I tried to take my life. So it was a big risk to do. But the reason why I made that decision was because I had given the care system a shot. And they failed me, they didn't do what they were supposed to. My health was getting worse by being under the professionals. And I just sat back and I thought, if I'm going to get better, then I need to do it on my own. And it was something that was a very spur of the moment decision. And I'm just grateful for the fact that it paid off and that I did end up knowing what I was doing. Like I trusted myself, and I made it happen. And even now, like years later, I still am the person that takes main control over my mental health. If I feel off on a day, I just take myself away for the day and I just focus on my awareness and I figure out exactly where it's coming from. And I take a lot of my approaches all come from mindfulness. Everything's holistic. I've never taken an antidepressant. I refuse to do it, because I want to know where the pain comes from, where the triggers come from. And that's why, like, even today, like I said, like everything comes from myself. I don't ever dismiss counseling and therapy from the professionals because they do work. I have had therapy before when I was 19. I had therapy for something that I'd gone through and it did make a difference. So I would never shun that down and say to somebody, don't do it. But what I would say is that learn to trust yourself more than you trust everybody else because we do have everything that we need inside of us. It's just more often we don't know how to tap into it or we don't love ourselves enough to trust it. We're so quick to trust everybody else around us and get everybody else's opinions, but nobody knows you like you know yourself.
It's really interesting you say that, actually. My dad always says about his anxiety, he never calls it that, but he always says he has to feel the pain. And he won't take any antidepressants either. He says, I need to feel the pain. and I just find that quite interesting. So you don't medicate because
I
you sort of
personally
have to
am
feel the
very
pain to come
much
through it. Is
against
that
any
what you
forms of
mean?
medication because I'm a very natural person. I like to take the natural, holistic approaches to everything because again, our bodies are self-healing. Our bodies were created to heal themselves. Medications and things like this, these are all man-made products that were introduced later on, and they all have side effects and things like this. And for me, I feel like if you're gonna get better, you need to
No,
get better
definitely.
naturally. You need to learn how to manage your emotions, how to question them, how to counteract them, how to healthily work through them, instead of taking a man-made pill that's just going to suppress the emotions and have your body start to rely on them. And then the one day you don't take that pill, you just go back to the way you were before. Like, for me, it's just, I'm just totally against that. And I've had, you know, people say to me that, yeah, but, you know, what if I take it while I'm getting therapy and then I'll wean myself off of them? And I just go, if that's what you want to do, that's totally up to you. You know, I personally just don't, I just don't agree with it. I believe that you can get through your problems without having to put something external into your body. I really, really strongly believe that you can get better without having to do that. It's just some people find it harder to also acknowledge that. Some people find comfort in the fact that there's something external that's helping them along the way. So it's a very, it's a touchy subject, and different people do have different opinions. There's people that I personally know that, you know, would take an antidepressant, but for me it was just a no-go.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm actually one of those people who are different. I do take antidepressants. But for me, and it's like I always say to people, they don't make me happy. They numb me. And I think I choose to do that, to try and numb myself and then deal with situations after. I know that they don't make me happy, that and that's fine. But, you know, maybe later on in life, it's something I'll look at gradually coming off. But you are right. There have been times where I've decided not to take my medication 4 days in and I'm shaking.
Exactly.
I'm
like, so your body started to rely on it, isn't it? So
I'm an absolute mess.
You feel like you need them in order to be able to function properly during the day. And that's the point that I didn't want to get to, because I knew that if I start taking these, like the doctors, they offered them to me, and I knew that if I take these, then this is where my life's going to go. And I don't want to go in that direction. And because I chose not to do it, the beginning of my recovery was a lot more intense because there are a lot more raw emotions coming up to the surface. But in the long run, it benefited me because I was able to become healthier a lot quicker than I would have if I was to have taken the antidepressants.
I think as well, a lot of the conversation around medication, it does come from the fact that when you do go to a GP, they will offer you talking therapy, but they will also give you medication at the same time. And when you're in that situation,
if the doctor says to you, take this, it's going to help, more often you will try anything, because they're the professionals. And you look at them as the people that know better. But we also have to remember that doctors are people that have been trained. The advice they're giving you and the things they're telling you and the medication they're offering you, they're offering it to you because that's how they were trained. That's what they were told to do. They were told, if somebody comes in with this issue, this is how you must respond, and this is what the medication does for them, et cetera, et cetera. Like, and that's it. But there are other alternatives, and there are other, like, I know personally that, like, if somebody came, like, if I was in that position and somebody, you know, had come to me and said, this is how I'm feeling, from a doctor's perspective, obviously you worry about your job. So even if you do have a different, you know, different belief, you don't want to lose your job. So you're just going to do what you've been told to do. But maybe on the outside, I've spoken to doctors that have said that there's a lot of things that they don't agree with. And even the neurologist that I had when I was going through my recovery, she had asked me what I was doing for my recovery. And when I explained to her what I was doing, she said to me, like, stick with what you're doing. Like, you've made real progress. I'm not going to give you any advice because I think you're doing the right thing. And instead of, you know, taking the approach that maybe she was trained to do, she just said to me, like, look, I'm not going to write anything down on here apart from the fact that you're doing a good job, because I can see that, you know, it's working. And after I had my, you know, my scans, she could see on the results that a vast improvement had been made. And what I was doing holistically and naturally was the right thing.
Yeah, definitely. like, as I said, I do take antidepressants, but good. I have also made other changes in my life, so dietary changes and things like that, and it is amazing. Just the things that you can do to improve your mood. So, you know, at some point, maybe it will be that I gradually come off my medication. But again, doctors, and from everything that I've seen from other people that use our Facebook page, doctors aren't exactly the greatest
source of being able to tell you how to get yourself off these drugs. This is why I trust myself more than I trust anybody else. Because of these reasons, like, nobody knows what's good for you more than you do. And especially with a lot of pills, is that they suppress a lot of your thoughts as well, your thought process. So whereas you, who's not on medication, might have been able to come up with a solution for a problem, you on medication are not able to, because your thoughts are being suppressed. And if you stop taking the medication, you know, your symptoms might flare up again, but you'll also be able to think differently too, which might trigger something positive. So it's definitely, like, you know, important to at least try to move on to that side. And I hope that, you know, whenever you're ready, I hope that you are able to come off the medication healthily, because I do believe that you would flourish a lot more without it. Of course, don't go cold turkey, because you're probably used to it by now. So yeah, do it slowly, definitely. Yeah,
I've done cold turkey a few times, and I'm not quite sure why I wanted to come off them, but I just felt the real urge, and it's not good. It's a car crash. It's not. But, you know, for everyone that's listening, obviously it's important to follow the advice of the GP as well, because we're all on different medications. Some people aren't on medications. So it's all about your own personal journey and when you feel comfortable. But I am so glad that you've been able to do it, on your own.
It was very intense. And I think, to be honest with you, one thing that I'm grateful for is that I was able to just go off on my own. Had I have had anybody else to think about at the time, it might have been a lot harder for me. So the fact that I was now single, and you know nobody needed me, nobody needed to rely on me for anything at that point in my life, I was able to literally prioritize myself to the point where my actions and my emotions didn't affect anybody else around me. So that definitely worked in my favor. But, you know, for the sake of people that are parents, or people that are carers, or people that have parents that rely on them and things like that, it might be a longer process, because you've got people that are now, like, rely on you, but it's not impossible.
No, and I think that's one of the reasons I've stuck with my medication, to be honest with you, for my children. As I said, they don't make me happy, but they help me just get by, I guess, and help me rationalize my anxiety a little bit more. So again, it's a journey, and it will go wherever it needs to go, I guess. But
And that's the most important thing, is that you're here, and that you're okay, and that at least you're not declining. You know, maintenance is a lot better than declining and deteriorating.
So just to sort of wrap up, what's next for you then? So obviously we've still got the pandemic.
I have a lot of plans. I'm just taking it step by step, studying as well at the moment alongside my work, just to increase my knowledge in the aspects of mental health that I might not have enough experience in compared to others. So I've been studying a lot. I've been obviously directly coaching and supporting people. And I've been raising awareness online, so through social media, again through podcast and radio, and some TV appearances I've done during the pandemic as well. So there's a lot of that going on. But in terms of what I'm working on in the future, is that I'm working on developing some more products and services that will support people in maintaining their positive mental health, or healing the things that they're going through and creating positive mental health instead. So right now I have my ebook out, and then I also have my direct coaching program. So the ebook is, you can find it directly on my website anyway, which is halimaspeaks.com. And to get direct support from me as well, anybody that needs it or just wants to inquire about it can just reach out directly to me. No worries. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for coming on this podcast. You know, it's been brilliant to talk to you, and I hope we can sort of collaborate.
There's any opportunity to bring awareness on there.
The more awareness we can raise, the better, right? So,
thank you. Take care.
All right, then. Thank you very much for joining us, Halima.